Hi, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Michael Laffin, professor at Princeton University, about his great new book, The Makings of Indonesian Islam, Orientalism, and the Narration of a Sufi Past. Michael, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Before we get kind of into the details of this very richly documented book, and I will say now that we will not be able to cover maybe even half of what you do in this book, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Islamic studies, maybe some influential advisors or people that really inspired you in this field.
Actually, I suppose it's all an accident. I was originally thinking I would do engineering at university, and when that didn't really pan out after a year of not-so-successful classes, I fell back on something that I'd done in high school, which was Indonesian. And growing up in Australia, Indonesia and Indonesian seemed like a logical subject to study, but I never really thought that it would lead to anything much in the future. It was always something I enjoyed. But as time went on, I sort of switched courses from engineering back to, I suppose, what you would call a liberal arts degree here in area studies. And lacking direction, I picked up Indonesian again and decided to just try something new. And it was Arabic, although it could have been Thai or Korean at the time. And so I picked up Arabic, or started to pick it up, and I just found I really enjoyed studying the language so much that I wanted to think of any way I could that could, you know, keep me working with Arabic and also working with Indonesian. And I suppose as time went on too, I realized that the things that really connect these two parts of the world, and there are deep connections. You have a lot of Arabic in Indonesian, perhaps upwards of 20-30% of the vocabulary is drawn from Arabic. But of course, it's not a Semitic language. As time went on, I realized that, what connected these two places together was, of course, Islam and Islamic history. And I suppose I came into Islamic studies just wanting to understand a little bit more about these connections, and realizing that, you know, you couldn't get very far in talking about Indonesia today without having some understanding of the religion that the majority of the population professes.
Was there any kind of like turning point where you said, wow, I really, I'm going to become a professional in Islamic studies? Or was it just a series of accidents?
Well, I don't know. I was always sort of drifting along and not quite sure what I was a specialist in. Indeed, my first project was much more linguistically oriented rather than, you know, religiously oriented. When I was doing my honours year at the ANU in Australia, the Australian National University, I worked on the Malay translation of an Arabic book written in the early part of the 20th century about the rise of Japan. So, and it was about a story of how a secular narrative about the rise of an Eastern nation, which defeated Russia in the war of over influence in Korea, how that was translated and in a sense Islamized. But, you know, I still didn't think of myself as someone who did Islamic studies per se. Indeed, when I started my doctoral dissertation, it was going to be a study of a Dutch Orientalist who looms large in my writings, I must admit. But as time went on, when I looked at the papers of this Orientalist, Snoeke Groenje, in the Netherlands, in preparation for the PhD, I realized that there was a far more important story in the papers, and that was the story of Indonesians themselves, the Indonesians he was supposed to observe, to manage in a way, because he later took on the role of being the advisor to the colonial state, the Dutch colonial state in the Netherlands Indies. It's in part, when did I decide I was someone who did Islamic studies? I'm not sure that I would say so narrowly that I am just someone who studies Islam. But I certainly work on the history of Muslims and the relationship between Muslims and people of other religions.
Could you tell us a little bit about how this project came about? And I'm wondering also if you could, since this is your second book, if there's any kind of reflection on how about going writing your first book versus the second book?
Well, the second book was much harder, and in part because I didn't really have that deadline. But the first book was the result of a doctoral dissertation, and, you know, with a doctorate or a PhD, you think, okay, I've only got so many years, this is a project, it's an exercise, I've got only a certain amount of time to gather the material, put it together, and then, you know, synthesize something and show people what I can do. So that worked okay, and then when I finished the PhD, which was looking at the importance of Egypt or thinking about reformist Islam at the end of the 19th century, its importance in shaping the notions of the boundaries of Indonesia in the colonial period. You know, the idea that what was it that united people from various parts of the archipelago, and how was that sense of confraternity accentuated or awakened through travel to the Middle East, through either for the Hajj in Arabia or indeed for extended periods of study in cities like Cairo. So that was the first project, and, you know, it was a relatively doable project in a way, whereas the second project was something that I never quite set in stone, you know, thinking about what is really going on here. It was more about reaction to a number of things, reaction to stereotypes about the supposed, you know, the nature of Islam in Southeast Asia, which is often expressed in terms, you know, antithetical somehow to Islam in other places. You know, the idea that, of course, there are cultural zones, you could say, there are styles of Islam, but the idea that somehow everything was explained through the moment of conversion never really satisfied me. And I was interested in tracing the lineaments of how the idea of how this idea came to be, and indeed how this idea is so popular in Indonesia itself today. And that idea basically is that somehow, you know, through some sort of mystical accommodation, that, you know, Indonesians were first drawn to convert to Islam in, say, the 13th century, it seems, 12th, 13th century, and how, you know, slowly over time, you know, the religion took root and eventually became sort of a crucial means of resistance to the increasing colonial presence in the region, particularly not just the Portuguese in the 16th century, but then more particularly the Dutch, who, through the Dutch East India Company, began to exercise ever greater influence over the archipelago. So it was a project that was very large, and again, I felt I was just working through the materials, trying to make sense of them myself, and try to see, you know, how it was that the representatives of the Dutch East India Company, you know, came to understand Islam, or when they came to think that Islam was worth understanding, and then looking, you know, in the successor to the Dutch East India Company, which really was wound up at the end of the 18th century, in the 19th century, with the increasing assertion of rule by the metropolitan Dutch kingdom, you know, and how when the business of colonialism, as we understand it, perhaps really took shape in the 19th century, how it was that Islam was seen from the colonial side. Now, that's only half the story, of course, and the other part of the story is to understand how, you know, Indonesians themselves were perhaps seeing Islam, or and what were the trends. You know, people tend to speak too much, I think, or too easily about a constant process of reform, and, you know, there's a teleology of ever greater connection with the Middle East and ever greater purification and, in a sense, changing of the character of Islam in Southeast Asia. And I was more interested in seeing, well, looking at the dynamic process, not seeing it just in terms of missionaries coming from the Middle East, Arab or Indian or otherwise, and seeing, you know, how Indonesians themselves from various parts, or what we now call Indonesians, were actively engaging across the Indian Ocean and returning, and what sort of notions they were bringing back with them, and how both the religious life of the archipelago changed, but also how the political life of the archipelago was shaped by the religion. I've probably rabbited on a little bit too much. No, I know there are lots of things embedded in here.
Yeah, So two of the real strengths of this book, which I think make it a great model for other authors, is you really could have made several books out of this one book, because you look at these kind of multi-pronged relational activities. So you have Dutch authorities, you have missionaries, you have Muslims that are from Indonesia, you have Muslims abroad, and you look at all these various interactions and how they view each other. And you do this in kind of this very it's almost a genealogy of sorts, the way you approach this. And I think it really adds to the value of this work. Can you take us kind of to the early history of Islam in the area? You talk about some of the sources that are available for constructing an early history in the area. What can we do with those sources? How should we understand those? What are they telling us?
Right. Well, you know, in many ways, I look back and people have said, yes, you could have done many books with this. And I read that as a gentle criticism, and it's a fair one too. You know, it's when you're reading all this, or you think you're trying to read all this stuff, you tend to put things down on the page in perhaps too shorthand a way. And, you know, you can leave people a little bit confused with a boggle of names, and I fully admit that I'm a little bit anxious about that. But I also felt that it was really important to put the people in as much as possible, and recognize that it's a complicated picture. But yes, the way to try and make sense of it was indeed to try and construct, you know, it's sort of a genealogical approach, both from the Indonesian sources and also from the Dutch sources. Now, as far as the sources go, you know, in the way you have to read the Dutch sources against the grain, so to speak, you know, to look for what might be going on, what might be partially observed or not observed. And not all the sources are Dutch either, I should say. Quite a few English sources I was looking at. And the missionaries really come in a big way in the 19th century. A friend of mine has chided me and said I was a bit tough on the missionaries, you know, a little bit too cynical. And, he has his point there. But I think it's really important to plug the missionaries into the story, otherwise, and see how crucial they were in the 19th century for, sure, they didn't like what they saw necessarily, and they were looking for ways to, you know, to get in, to convert Muslims to Christianity. But by the same token, it was their on-the-ground observations that needed to be contrasted with these sort of fixed ideas that some more scholarly observers had, which were grounded more in texts. And it was always about measuring text, what the text said should be going on against what it seemed that people were doing, and you know, in many senses, judging them as not living up to the standards of their faith. And that's where people like Snook come in, and the missionaries who preceded him. And they recognized that people were, you know, Muslim as much in Indonesia as they were, say, in Egypt. If you were going to, say, you know, imagine that there's a pure standard somewhere by which people either fail or succeed as Muslims, then you're not really looking at the religion properly. But in terms of going on the other side, I must confess at the outset that, I mean, Indonesia and indeed Southeast Asia, it's a very, very diverse place. You're dealing with lots of languages here. And because of my own background, I don't have Javanese, for example, or Buginese, or some of the other languages of the archipelago. And I really work with what are Malay sources, or Malay is now Indonesian. But these are sources written in a language using Arabic script, but in a language that was accessible to a great many people in the archipelago. And Malay wasn't just a language of you know, communication. It wasn't just a bizarre language, as some might imagine. It really was a language of learning, of scholarship. And many people in the archipelago would have, you know, understood, you know, Islam through Malay sources, or at least translations of Malay sources, which were themselves either translated from Arabic or, you know, digested from various Arabic works. Now, of course, it's not possible for me to read absolutely everything. Some of the Malay histories, so to speak, or chronologies are much more devoted to valorizing or validating particular rulers in the region at various times, particular sultans. And also when it comes down to looking for expressions of religion, many of the primers, the basic books that people would have used in religious schools, were much more, there's a certain modularity to them. They're not the most exciting reading in some senses because they're explaining the basic principles of religion. So, you know, what you can get out of those is not necessarily that great either if you're trying to reconstruct a lineage. It's more important to see when particular books come in and out of favor. And then when it comes to the question of looking at mysticism or Sufism, and here I was looking at the idea that somehow mysticism had to be connected to particular, for want of a better term, orders or lineages of scholars and mystics. Then here was an area where we could start to look at the sources and say, well, you know, how far back do these lineages go? And in here the textual sources are, in a way, they're not so difficult to read in that if you're looking for the genealogical components, you're looking, often there's an explicit listing given by a teacher of who their teacher was and who their teacher's teacher was all the way back. And these lineages, these silsila, or chains, literally, of authority are really worth looking at and thinking about, well, you know, how does this help us understand when a particular style of Sufi teaching comes into a particular place? Always recognizing that, you know, silsilas can be written and reconstructed at later times, but trying to see what matches up, you know, and whether we can twin, for example, any, you know, we see changing practices in Java and across the archipelago in the 19th century. Is this connected in some way with the rise of a particular Sufi order known as the Naqshbandiya, which became popular in Syria and in the holy places in Mecca and Medina in the 19th century, after in the wake of the first Saudi rulership over those sites. So, you know, can we say that these changes are attributable to particular Sufi lineages or not? And so that's where those sources come in. And again, it bounces back and looking at the colonial lens, which really opens up for Southeast Asia and Indonesia in particular at the end of the 19th century, when you can say that what is now Indonesia really starts to come much more clearly into view, that the borders are being fixed and the last of these once independent Muslim sultanates are being brought more directly under Dutch authority.
Now, Michael, I don't think anyone would charge you with not looking at enough sources. This is a very, very rich narrative you present us with the amount of sources you go through. But if I read you correctly, when we actually get to see very clearly what sources are being used by Muslims, it seems to be happening around the mid to late 18th century, and you look at educational institutions. Could you tell us a little bit about what kind of sources these Muslims are using within education? And I guess I should mention that you do this kind of – one of the main arguments you're trying to make is that against this kind of Sufi narrative that all Muslims in the area, they're just interested in Sufism or they're related to Sufism. And what can these texts that are used in educational institutions tell us against that narrative maybe?
Right. Well, you know, first, I felt, in terms of sources, I felt I really, in retrospect, haven't looked enough at contemporary Indonesian scholarship. And I make that, you know, as a note of apology from the outset. I think there's a lot of fantastic work that's being done by Indonesian scholars, such as Oman Fathur Rahman, for example, who have been doing similar things going into these silsilas, and in fact going in more depth than I have or can. But in terms of looking at the sources for the 18th century, in a way I was looking at an archive of material that was, you could say, captured often. You know, these are materials that were taken at the end of the 18th century and in the 19th century. And so they offer us a particular perspective on the sorts of education that may have been available to people in courts, for example, royal courts, rather than necessarily out in the smaller schools, for want of a better term, out in the countryside. Now, here's a key problem, though. In Indonesia today, there's an assumption that the form of the school, as is now known in Indonesia, the pesantren, the place of the students or santris, has been there from the beginning. You know, that particular teachers, Sufi or otherwise, inculcating Islam in the local population, set established schools. Now, whilst that's possible, we are struck with the problem in that we have no sources that actually identify what we would call a pesantren before the 18th century, I believe. And even then, these are tangential observations. It seems rather that education took place or was, you know, identified with the mosque rather than a separate, you know, sort of a boarding school that we would now see in many parts of the archipelago. But in terms of, you know, these collections, we do start to see extensive collections of materials from pesantren from the 19th century. And I should say pesantren is a Javanese term. It's different parts of the archipelago have different names for what is something like a religious boarding school. And these schools rose and fell very much with the fame of the local teacher. You know, that people would move from place to place looking for particular expertise and knowledge that often translated in terms of knowledge of a particular text, be it a text on, you know, elementary jurisprudence or another text that might be connected to a particular mystical teaching or a philosophical text. So people tended to move around a lot. These days, of course, the institutions have started to take on lives of their own and outlive the original founders or the families that were connected with them. But in terms of what people were learning, I think the crucial difference, or at least for the stuff I was interested in my book, was the impact that print had in the 19th century on the sort of standardization of the scholarly diet of someone in a religious school. And also we have to realize that religious schools are not necessarily geared to producing religious teachers per se. They may have made people, of course, very excited about the idea of continuing on in this tradition, but the vast bulk of pupils at a religious school were receiving education in writing, basic literacy, and ethical education, which could then be taken onto any part of life, you know, whether you were engaged in trade or working as a farmer or even towards the end of the 19th century being absorbed by the colonial state as an official, as some individuals were. Now, I haven't really spoken about the key. I suppose being a historian, I'm always looking for differences. You know, what are the texts that come in favour and what come out? And I don't know, I think there's a striking amount of continuity in many of the texts, at least at the basic level, of the juridical level. And when I say juridical, it's perhaps an overly formulaic term to use here, but just so that people knew how, when you were in a state of ritual purity or not, you know, what to eat, what not to eat. But questions, more legal questions, that were still taught, you know, how inheritance was to be determined, how marriage was to be conducted, etc. These sorts of issues then became increasingly under the realm or the purview of the colonial state. You know, criminal law no longer became something that was handled by Islamic law, rather that many issues were being handled from at the end of the 19th century by, you could say, specially convened courts that were overseen by Dutch residents and took the advice of local scholars. And increasingly, you know, the information that was at hand as to what, you know, what Islamic law was and how standardized it was increasingly printed. And there were manuals available more and more or texts that were available and which could be purchased from afar afield as Egypt, for example, or the Ottoman Empire. Or even from the 1880s, there was a press active in Mecca that was producing these guidebooks in Malay and in Arabic, which were then spread throughout the archipelago.
Another thing that I think is really integral to your study here and your previous book as well are these trans-regional connections. I don't think you have a specific point where you talk about this explicitly in the book, but it's scattered throughout. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of these connections with the Middle East, both for Muslims and then maybe how foreigners were concerned about these connections.
Mm. Right. Well, I mean, in many ways, I never particularly worried too much about whether what I did was transnational history or not. And I suppose rather like the sources that I read, people aren't so concerned about. Of course, they recognize that they're traveling, they're moving to other places, but they're not necessarily foreign places all the time. And these connections are of long standing and make sense to people. You know, the idea, of course, for every believer, if they're able to and capable of doing it, is to perform the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. But of course, that comes along with the desire to visit many of the places where the Prophet had been active and his companions. And then, of course, the further impetus to travel to other centres to study. Now, not everyone who left would go and study, but the point is that over time, the sheer numbers of people who were able to make these journeys across the Indian Ocean increased. Whereas once, you know, in order to travel all that way to Mecca from Indonesia, required money, required support, often the sort of support that could be lent by a royal authority, was supplanted more and more in the 19th century, that there were more and more people who were able to save up and had the economic capacity to make the pilgrimage or to support a family member who would wish to study abroad. And more, it's actually the tightening up of these colonial networks in the 19th century and of the opening of the Suez Canal, the rise in passing steam shipping, shipping that was handled both by European companies and also by Arab companies operating out of Singapore and other sites in the archipelago, saw more and more people able to make these journeys. And these journeys became more and more organized. And I think you see that ever greater numbers are moving and people in motion, both Indonesians moving across to the Middle East for purposes of pilgrimage and study, and not necessarily return either. Some people aspired to even pass away in the Holy Land. There were, by the same token, you also had greater numbers of people moving from what is now Yemen, from Hadramaut into Southeast Asia and having an impact on Islam, people looking for, you know, livelihoods and awakening connections in the opposite direction. So you see that, you know, it's indeed one of the peak years. I think I might be wrong here, 1888 or thereabouts. The sheer numbers of pilgrims from what is now Indonesia actually vastly outnumbered those from any other place, including India at the time. And they became a much more visible presence in the Holy Land by the end of the 19th century, and a visible market, it should be said, too. But these connections continue today. You know, you have the pilgrimage now as something that's organized by the Indonesian state. There is, of course, a cap on how many people can go, just to cope. The modern Saudi authorities have to put a limit on how many people can travel. But it really is this important process for the Indonesian nation today too.
Now, in the second section of the book, you basically focus on kind of the Dutch colonial perspective on what exactly is going on in the area. And one of the things that seemed striking was the Dutch fixation on scholarship about Islam. Could you talk a little bit about why that was so important to them and how they went about doing that? Because you mentioned Clifford Geertz in the beginning, but no one is really interested in what Muslims are doing.
Well,
they're more interested in texts, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I suppose that was a point I was trying to make, although, you know, sometimes I worry that I might have missed. I mean, for example, in the 19th century, it's not just a straightforward story of the Dutch coming in and overwhelming parts of the archipelago and finally joining it all together. It's things, the Dutch were sometimes just bit players in parts of the archipelago. They were even shunted aside briefly by the British during the Napoleonic period. Indeed, there was even a British governor of Java for a few years, from 1811 to 1816, who he and his colleagues were quite interested in what was going on. And they Raffles was one, of course, we might have heard of, but there were others, Mackenzie, who wrote quite detailed information about the practice of Islam, even if they were, it was, of course, through the lens of disapproval, you know, seeing Indonesians or seeing Javanese in particular as imperfect believers at best. Superficial Muslims is often the sort of characterization that one meets in some of these earlier sources. That reflects, I think, more superficial encounters or a desire to see a certain sort of Islam, or not even to see Islam at all. Perhaps in part it's because Islam was not necessarily seen as a threat, a coordinated threat. Indeed, in parts of Java, the Dutch in the 18th century were encouraging of Islam against the impact of Balinese rule in East Java, or Balinese. The Balinese were seen as someone, you know, perhaps they could deal with less. Now, just going back to the question of scholarship, some have made the argument, Karel Steenbrink, for example, argues that early Dutch sources on Islam are not particularly fulsome because it reflects a sense that they feel they already know what Islam is. You know, they've had long communication with Muslim states, with Muslims. Indeed, the Dutch and sometimes the English had quite good relations with Muslim states, whether that in terms of the Ottoman Empire or the North Africa, against the Iberians, for example. I find it quite interesting indeed that when the Dutch first get to the Moluccas, the Spice Islands, at the end of the 16th century, one of the people who encourages them and shows them around is a Turkish spice procurer who happened to be present there at the time. So the relationship with Islam was not always antithetical. But really what one does see in the 19th century is this sense of the tightening up of control, of getting in the business of ruling over Muslims, not just, you know, in name of the local sultanates, but really ruling and counting and trying to decide, well, you know, how many Muslims are there in Java? How many schools are there? These are things that are done surprisingly late. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, you could say that contact with thinking about Islam was much more seen through the lens of the nearer Muslims, and the collections that are held at Leiden University, for example, has a fabulous collection of Islamic materials. But many of it is many materials are really, and the older stuff is much more from the Middle East, from the Ottoman Empire. And that's not born of a colonial relationship. It's just born of a long-standing trading relationship. Meanwhile, coming to grips with Arabic, too, could be seen the preserve of some scholars. It was more Arabic that was studied in order to better understand Hebrew, to try and reconstruct. Well, it's through biblical scholarship and that sort of lens that, you know, Islam was sort of an ancillary inconvenience, one might say. But in the 19th century, it became much more clearly the case that Islam was a force that allowed people of various parts of the archipelago to see commonality and to also unite against the intrusion of Dutch power, and that was seen very visibly in the Padri the wars in Sumatra, but also in the rising of Prince Diponegoro on Java in the 1830s. But back to, 1825 to 1830, but back in Sumatra, people like Raffles and others started to speculate, you know, where does Islam come from? And often they would want to see someone else behind things. They often pointed to the increasing numbers of Arabs that they saw or met in the archipelago, increasing number of Hajis, pilgrims. And it was felt that, you know, these influences were stemming from Mecca, and that they were new somehow, rather than seeing them as an old part of the fabric of connections between places. And indeed, I think it was Raffles was the first to speculate that the Padris in West Sumatra were some form of Wahhabi, you know, that somehow there had to be some sort of necessary similarity between what they were doing in West Sumatra with what had been done very recently in Mecca and Medina. So, I mean, I wanted to sort of pick away at some of these things too.
Yeah. Now you, in the third section, it's almost like a case study in this, this body of kind of, colonial native, encounters. So, and you focus on this figure, Snook. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the rest of the name.
It's enough to just say Snook and yeah.
But perhaps you could, introduce us to Snook, tell us who he was, how he fits into kind of what you've been talking about as far as these kind of, scholarship in Leiden and both in Indonesia.
Well, Snook, he's nothing if not an interesting character. One would say almost domineering, incredibly smart person. He originally enrolled at Leiden University in the 1880s to study theology. And like many, you know, who became Orientalist scholars in the end, they came often with a you could say a theological background or a church background. But he changed. I mean, he studied Arabic initially to help his Hebrew, and then it took over. He ended up writing a dissertation on the history of the Hajj. And then, in part because he didn't have a job directly to go to, he was working for the Colonial Institute, but he was subsidized to go on a trip to Jeddah, to where the Dutch consulate was from the 1870s. And the Dutch, by this time, were monitoring the pilgrims all the way from, you know, from their various regencies in the Netherlands Indies, and also on the journey there, you know, the pilgrims were required to present themselves at Dutch consulates on the way, whether it's, say, Singapore or Colombo. And then ultimately through the processing facilities that the Ottomans were forced to set up in Cameron Island in the Gulf, in the Red Sea. And then, you know, at the last point was the Jeddah consulate itself. And that was as far as the colonial state could see. You know, the colonial state was wondering at this time in 1884, you know, what were the influences that people were coming under? Who were these Sufis, by the way? And indeed, you could say in the 1880s, the Dutch looked at the Sufi orders as some sort of nebulous network, you know, sort of an Al-Qaeda of the time, you know, that somehow had its headquarters in Mecca or may perhaps have been influenced by the Ottoman Sultan. They really weren't clear on all this. And they wanted someone to interview the pilgrims before they headed off on the last part of their journey, and, you know, got on, often boarded a camel to be taken to the holy places. Well, Snook decided to go one bit further and converted to Islam, if only in name. And it should be said, too, that he really, I think, was a religious... I wouldn't say cynical necessarily, but he was more an observer of religion than a practitioner. Even if he carried off the pretense or at least carried off the outward manifestation of Islam so well that people really did think he was a Muslim, at least Muslims did. And he joined with some Indonesians in Mecca and set about sort of observing what went on in the Holy City. And although he tended to play to the colonial fears of the Sufi orders, and indeed used his time in Mecca and the work he wrote to point to the need for better knowledge of what actually happened in religious schools in the Indies and what were the Sufi networks, in order to get himself another job, and that was basically to conduct a study tour of Java in 1889-1890, you could see that he really began to see less and less a story of fear to be manufactured from the Sufi networks, but more he wanted to just understand the history of Islam, Islamization, and to I think you could say he developed quite some sympathy with Muslims. And it's not just about playing the part of being a Muslim, but, you know, in many ways, he got on much better with the Muslims he met and studied with than some of the officials he worked with, and many of whom he despised, it should be said. He never really wanted to be an academic. I think he always wanted to be a field man, a scholar, out in the field who was putting their knowledge to the service of the colonial state. And it should be pointed out that he might have had some sympathies for Muslims, but I think he always thought in terms of a paternalistic relationship between the Netherlands and the Netherlands Indies. You know, he increasingly wrote in the 20th century of, you know, the need, a future relationship between the two places, but it was always going to be a relationship between the Netherlands and Indonesia, and that he advocated that more and more Indonesians should be provided with, you know, as good an education as any Dutch person was able to get, and so that they could take on the reins of government. But I don't think he necessarily thought of an independent Indonesia. He stayed in the Indies until he went back to the Netherlands in 1906, and for what was going to be a temporary stay, but he remained there and as a professor of Arabic, among other things, in Leiden University. And organized and, you know, brought many, many texts back from Indonesia at that time. And he really, until the 1930s, you could say he had the controlling hand on the training of future officials to be sent to the Indies, but also for quite some time, the discourse about how Islam was to be understood and to be managed. Let's be quite frank here, that, you know, he was the key man in the colonial project. He did a very effective job of, I'd say, downplaying the work of anyone before him, and very much it was his followers who continued on and really dominated the study of Islam in Southeast Asia.
Now, just for sake of time, we've obviously skipped a lot of detail here. But maybe you could talk about in the early 20th century some of the trends that are happening. We have what we might call reform movements, and we have many of Snook's successors either looking at or active in Southeast Asia. Could you tell us kind of what's happening during this period?
Sure. Well, I should say that Snook was always at the head of an organization that was really charged with giving advice to the colonial state, but which did not make the decisions. And increasingly towards the 1920s, you know, the decisions of the Office for Native Affairs, as it was called, were often ignored because it was felt that they had played a role in letting some sort of genie out of the bottle, that, you know, that the encouragement that Snook and others had given towards Islamic reform movements, saying that, look, these organizations, they're about creating loyal subjects who better understand their religion, who better understand the texts of their faith, and who are opposed to all sorts or all manner of, let's say, unorthodox behavior that one might find out in the countryside, that, you know, they had encouraged these organizations. They had, through the influence on the Governor General, encouraged the recognition of Sarakat Islam, which was the sort of first founded really in 1911, 1912. It emerged as a really important body for people to come together. And the very name Sarakat Islam, or Islamic Association, was felt to be something that gave voice to natives, you know, indigenous Indonesians of many places, in calling for reforms, not necessarily of religion, but more as of you know, providing a voice to indigenous population. There were other organizations like Muhammadiyah, founded around the same time, which was much more about Islamic reform, but also about, in a way, going about as the missionaries had of establishing schools, welfare associations, newspapers. This was really crucial in the 20th century, and of creating, you know, giving a voice to people. Now, of course, when they were giving themselves a voice and not necessarily calling for independence or resistance, then that was fine as far as elements within the colonial state were concerned. But by turns, particularly after the First World War, when various promises weren't honoured, of greater participation in politics, and even after the founding of a sort of a token parliament for elite Indonesians, you can see that by the 1920s there's a real shift towards advocating greater resistance to the colonial state and visualizing an independent future, which was not necessarily controlled by these Islamic organizations. But certainly many Muslim reformers were principled nationalists too. And they came out of these reform schools very much embodied with a vision of the future, or the idea of even the very idea of a place called Indonesia, which began to be bandied about in the 1920s. Although the people who first, even the term Indonesia had been a scholarly invention from the middle of the 19th century, but was increasingly accepted by Indonesians, much as it was a term not tolerated by the Dutch colonial state. Although people like Snook used the word Indonesia in their writings. But in terms of the reformist movement, I should say that many of the key movers of Muhammadiyah and others were looking towards thinkers in Cairo above all else, people like Muhammad Abdu, who had been a prominent reformer, called for sort of a similar sort of a package of modernization that through adapting to and adopting Western techniques of education and certain Western subjects, you know, bookkeeping was incredibly popular in reformer schools, and modern languages, English, and even the teaching of Arabic, say, for purposes not just for understanding religious texts, but also for communication, for Islamic brotherhood across the ocean, you could say. They were looking at these sorts of thinking. People like Muhammad Abdu and Rashid Rida in Cairo were extremely important and for the thinkers in Southeast Asia. But it's important to note, too, that there were plenty of thinkers in Southeast Asia, too, who were writing for each other, people who were active in Singapore, too. And I also feel important to state that in my book I try to look at sources outside Indonesia at all times in the region as well. I mean, Singapore, which was under British control, was always an important place. Even if Muslims became ultimately a small minority on the island, it was a place where the press was freer than in the Netherlands Indies, where ideas could be communicated. And, of course, the natural zone, the backyard for Singapore, is Indonesia, as it is today too. Singapore may complain about smoke haze, but a lot of that money that's invested and coming, you know, from the planting of these palm oil trees ends up in Singapore, so they don't want to complain too loudly. But or say so too with ideas and movement, that Singapore has been a really important place, and indeed the Malaysia has been important for Indonesia too.
Well, Michael, we've taken a lot of your time, but before I let, yeah, thank you very much. Before I let you go, though, I'd love to hear about some of the things you're working on or things you have coming out.
Sure. Well, I think I'm coming out of from under my rock. I'm doing my best to escape Snooker Koronya, and so I'm heading into the 18th century more and more, looking at and you know, of course, finding that I might not have been as right as I hoped I was in some instances. No, I'm looking at a sort of a history of connections again, but to another place, and that's to Cape Town. The VOC, the Dutch East India Company, which was, you know, really the world's first transnational corporation, had bases from South Africa all the way to Japan in the 17th century and into the 18th century. Well, a place when they felt that they were being resisted in particular courts or people weren't doing what they wanted, the logical sites of exile or deposition were either Sri Lanka or South Africa. And a great many of the Muslims of South Africa today have ancestors who came from the Indonesian archipelago, although many of them also came from India too, and Mozambique and Madagascar. But you can say that the Islamic culture in Cape Town was very much a Southeast Asian Islamic culture, and I'm interested in the story of some of these exiles. And whilst on the one hand you have a there's quite a literature about what some of these exiles did in Cape Town, there's less awareness of who these people were before they were sent to Cape Town. So I've been following the trajectories of a number of people who are now buried and honoured as saints in Cape Town and looking at their Indonesian past histories. One was a member of a group from the Eastern Moluccas who was sent out in 1780 for trying to encourage the British against the Dutch. Another is an Arab who came from Yemen, it seems, in the 1730s, came to Java and was incredibly influential at the court of in the court of Central Java, and who in fact was blamed for the loss of the garrison to combined Javanese and Chinese forces in 1741, and was sent to Cape Town. So I'm looking at these stories of movement and deposition, and trying to sort of connect these stories, connect an African story to a Southeast Asian story. And there'll be other people who I hope I can use to connect to a Sri Lankan story or an Arabian story, and try and do some sort of, for want of a better term, global history, but look at the people who have Jawi connections, Southeast Asian connections.
That sounds great. Well, thanks again for talking with us, and we look forward to reading your future work too.
Thanks so much. Well, I hope that the next one could be a bit more readable.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
You're very welcome, Christian.